Do I have a laser pointer here? Like, is
this button right there?
Okay, thanks. Okay, what I'm going to talk about today pretty much follows straight in from what Bob was talking about during the first part of his talk on the time frequency S transform. What I'm going to do is talk a little bit about the S transform, but mostly about the time-time TT transform that is associated with the S transform, and I'll show some examples of how it localizes signal and image features. So to give a brief overview, incidentally, I'm using Preview instead of Adobe Acrobat because Acrobat doesn't show some of the figures very well, so we're going to have to put up with that little thing popping up at the beginning of every slide. Sorry about that. What I'm actually going to start with is the Gabor transform, because as it turns out, the Gabor transform also has its own time-time distribution, which is quite a bit simpler than the one associated with the S transform. And so it's a very nice way of introducing the idea of what exactly I mean by a time-time distribution. So having talked about that, I'll move on to the S and TT transforms and show some examples. Then I'll discuss some of the properties of the TT transform. TT is for time-time, of course, for want of a better name. And then I'll talk about the TT transform in the continuous domain. And then, having talked about the one-dimensional case, I'll move on to the two-dimensional case, the S transform and TT transform for two-dimensional images. Well, if we start with the Gabor transform, well, I'll just begin with this statement that's in boldface at the top, that each local spectrum of a Gabor transform is the Fourier transform of a windowed time series, which of course is very familiar to pretty much everyone here. And I'm just phrasing it this way to sort of showcase the fact that you can think of the Gabor transform or the short-time Fourier transform as a collection of local spectra. Okay, that if you have a very large number of local spectra, when you put them all together, you get the Gabor transform, of course. And just to look at the mathematical statement of what I just said, if we use this double arrow notation that's sometimes used to denote Fourier transform pairs, well, on one hand, we've got our windowed time series, which is going to be a function of time t. This is the original signal. This is the Gaussian window. Both of them are going to be a function of running time t, the time variable of the original data. And, of course, the window also has to depend upon tau, which is the localization midpoint, right? And so the Fourier transform pair of that windowed time series will then be a local spectrum, which I've denoted by capital G for Gabor. So this is the time domain, and then frequency, our frequency variable is going to be K. Now, the Gabor transform is a time frequency distribution for the obvious reason that it's a function of a time variable and a frequency variable. Now, if we look at what we've got on the right-hand side, we've got a function of two time variables, the running time variable T and the localization point of the window, tau. So we can think of this as being a time-time distribution. Now, if we were to take the first equation that I showed, which is the one using double arrow notation, and express it in integral form, the way that we would normally go about doing that would be to express it this way, to think of the Gabor transform as being something that you get from the time series. That's natural to think of it that way. But you can also cast it this way. You can say, well, if we were to know the short-time Fourier transform, from that we could get back all of the windowed time series. Okay? So we can start, we can go back to the start, to the first statement that I had, and simply recast exactly the same reasoning in a different way. Each windowed time series is the inverse Fourier transform of a local spectrum of the short-time Fourier transform, which is pretty obvious, but this will become relevant in one or two slides. So here's an example of a Gabor transform. This is the original time series. There's the short-time Fourier transform. Of course, it has sort of classic appearance, the low-frequency component, the mid-range frequency component in the second half. These are just time-localized pure sinusoids. There's the high-frequency burst. And this is that time-time distribution, just the product of the original time series or function in the continuous domain with the window. So we can see pretty much immediate, well, before I say that, at this point what we have to decide is how are we going to represent the time-time distribution. We've got two time axes, so one of them's got to be horizontal and the other one's got to be vertical. So which is which? Well, it's sort of natural to want to use the t variable for the horizontal axis, because that way it's easy to associate the peaks and valleys of the time-time distribution. Of course, these are being given by the grayscale here, with corresponding peaks and troughs of the time series. However, I'm not going to do it that way, and the reason for that is that I want each column, which then is going to be a windowed time series, to be the Fourier transform pair of the local spectrum that's right above it, and which is associated with the point in between the two. So instead of having the rows be windowed time series, I'm going to have the columns be windowed time series. But because of the fact that we're losing that advantage of having the running time variable on the horizontal axis, what I'm going to do is take a few columns and I'm going to plot them on the right-hand side, and I'm going to have several overheads that are similar to this one for the rest of the talk. Here I've reproduced the original time series in the middle. The top three and the bottom three are just windowed time series with sort of the typical appearance that you would expect for that sort of thing. Now, when we move to the S transform, things are different. We have a distribution that certainly resembles the Gabor transform in that we still have the Fourier sinusoid over here, and we still have a Gaussian window, but the difference is that the window is now being permitted to depend upon the frequency. And, well, basically what that means is that we no longer can cast local spectra of the S transform as being something that we can very easily associate with the time series in the window via that arrow notation that I used a couple of overheads back. The reason for that, of course, is that we're using a different window at every frequency. So if we consider any particular local spectrum of the S transform at a given value of tau, at every frequency, we're actually using a different time series. The window is depending on F. And really, this isn't a windowed Fourier transform. And the reason is that it's not a Fourier transform at all. You can see the window depends on both K and T, and you can't have that, right? This whole function here, the product of the original function in the window, isn't supposed to be allowed to depend upon K if it was a Fourier transform. So that kind of arrow notation isn't appropriate in the first place. Nonetheless, once you've already got the S transform, at each value of tau, it is a function of frequency, and that means that if it's reasonably well behaved, it should have an inverse Fourier transform, which would then be a function of two time variables. So now, what's that going to look like? Well, what we're going to do is begin then by defining the TT transform to be the inverse Fourier transform of each column, each local spectrum of the S transform. So again, we're going to, in some sense, build it up one time series at a time. At each tau, we get all values of T from equation 7. And in the discrete domain, too, this is also the easiest way to get the TT transform. Get the S transform first, then get the TT transform. So this is what we end up getting. So this is very much analogous to the first overhead that I showed. This is the S transform, and it has that very sort of classic Morley wavelet transform type appearance. As Bob was saying earlier, the amplitudes of the S transform and the Morley wavelet transform are pretty much identical. Down here we have the TT transform, same time series, of course, and you can see just by looking at it that there are some differences in its sort of basic appearance. It's still more or less concentrating the amplitude around the t equals tau diagonal, and what that means for every column, for every time local time series, we still have some sort of localization. There's some kind of concentration of amplitude towards the window midpoint of each local spectrum here, but that localization isn't happening in the same way, because for the Gabor transform, what we basically had was just a swath along the middle that had amplitude, and there was nothing at all up here and nothing at all down here. Now, we're seeing that the lower frequencies are being allowed to spread out more away from the tau equals t diagonal, and the higher frequencies are being crushed in more towards the middle. The other thing, which perhaps isn't quite as obvious because of the grayscale that I've used, is that correspondingly, the higher frequencies have a larger amplitude than they did on the original time series, whereas it's maybe more obvious on the lower frequencies, they have a much smaller amplitude. So we have changes in the localization in both the tau direction and the t direction. And just to give an idea of what that actually means for the TT transform, perhaps the best thing to do is simply look at some of these time local time series, which are columns of this. This one pretty much says it all for the first point, which is the localization in the T direction, the vertical direction here. Here the window midpoint is right in the middle of the time series. This is a 256-point time series, and I've selected tau to be 127. You can see that the lower frequency has visible amplitude out to about here, whereas the mid-range frequency is only making it out about this far. So even though we know that the original mid-range frequency extends much further out, the TT transform only perceives it to within about 3 wavelengths away from the central point of the window. Okay. Similarly, if we start thinking in terms of the resolution in the tau direction, resolution this way, well, take a look at this particular localized function. For this function, that's approximately where the window midpoint would have been located. And of course, we're using a different window for every frequency. Well, it's perceiving the low frequency over pretty much the entire range of time over which it originally actually existed. But notice that the high frequency burst that is so obvious here isn't appearing here at all, even though we can still see the low frequency. And this is something that you wouldn't get from a windowed time series. Well, the reason that this is happening is that when the window midpoint is here, the low frequency is only about, say at this point, only about 1 wavelength away from the central point. But the high frequency is about 6 or 7 or 8 of its wavelengths away from the central point, and that's too far away. The TT transform only perceives each frequency to within about 3 wavelengths of that frequency away from t equals tau. So the localization properties are quite different. And the reason that I find this interesting is that because of the fact that the S transform is so closely connected to the Morley wavelet transform, in some sense, what this is telling us is how the wavelet transform perceives the time series at each instant. I mean, we know intuitively how the Gabor transform perceives the time series. It's seeing a windowed time series. The wavelet transform, though, or the Stockwell transform, is seeing something very different. Well, I had to think of some kind of term to describe the fact that the higher frequencies are crushed inwards towards t equals tau, so the best one I could think of was differential localization of different frequencies. And the thing that's interesting here is that the TT transform tries to do this even when the original signal is a monotonic sinusoid. If we were to take a windowed time series, well, here what I've done is I've taken a monotonic sinusoid, which is shown in the dashed line, and I've taken the TT transform of that corresponding to the window midpoint being right in the middle. So the TT transform For the window midpoint being at tau equals 128 is shown as the solid line. The original data is the dashed line. Now, if this was a windowed time series, the peaks and valleys would tend to move inwards a little bit just because of the taper of the window, but the zero crossings wouldn't move at all. Here, if you look carefully, you can see that not only are the peaks and valleys moving, but the zero crossings are also being pulled inwards close to the midpoint, t equals 128, which is t equals tau here. The other thing, which isn't quite so obvious unless you look closely, is what's going on away from the midpoint where the amplitude is starting to get low. Notice that once we get out here, and you may need to strain to see this, out here, the zero crossings of the TT transform are actually further away from the midpoint. And there's a point sort of halfway between, which is it evident here? Probably right about in here somewhere on that side, where they're the same distance away. So essentially what's happening is this is just sort of my intuitive interpretation of it, the higher frequencies are being pulled in towards the middle, so the lower frequencies are dominating further out, which is causing the wavelength to increase. So the instantaneous frequency actually increases near t equals tau and decreases further away. So what I've done here to show quantification of that is I've taken a complex sinusoid this time, not a real one, and I've calculated a TT transform, once again corresponding to the window midpoint being in the middle here. Now, I haven't shown the original sinusoid just to keep things from being cluttered, but the TT transform time series, this is of course the discrete case, is shown at the top. The real part is in blue. The imaginary part, which is a bit tough to see, is the dashed green line. And then the red dots show the amplitude of the complex modulus of the amplitude. Well, since it's a complex valued sinusoid, or pseudo-sinusoid in this case, you can get its instantaneous frequency quite easy just from the time changes in the phase angle. Well, I set up the original time series in such a way that it represented a monotonic sinusoid with a frequency of 1 hertz. Okay? This blue line in subplot B shows the instantaneous frequency for the TT transform, and as you would expect from the previous overhead, you can see that in the very middle where the amplitude is large, it does actually go above 1, and further away it drops off. The other thing is that if you look at the amplitude, which is shown as the red dots in the top figure, here I've plotted the log 10 of the amplitude. Well, if it was a Gaussian, we'd get a quadratic, but instead what we get is something that looks more kind of like a hyperbola. So what we have then is Gaussian amplitude decay very close to the peak, and then it becomes more exponential further out. This just shows a larger view of the TT transform from a couple of slides ago. And the reason I'm showing this is just to point out that the signatures of the peaks and troughs, which are the bright and dark alternating bands, if you look closely at them, they have sort of a sigmoidal appearance to them. They curve up a little bit at the edges, but they have opposite curvature in the middle. And essentially, keeping in mind that each column here is a time-local time series, the reason that that's happening is that close to the midpoint, the higher frequencies are being crushed inwards, and the lower frequencies are dominating at distance. The closest thing that the S-transform gets to satisfying it's a marginal of any kind is the inversion equation, which I think Bob's already shown, whoops, which is, of course, that if you just average all of the local spectra over time, you end up getting back the Fourier transform, here the discrete Fourier transform in the discrete case, of the original time series. I do have a tendency to forget myself when I'm talking in the continuous or discrete domains, and I use time series and function pretty much interchangeably. I hope you'll forgive me for that. It's something that I just don't seem to be able to get over. Anyways, for the TT transform, satisfying any sort of marginal in terms of summing power or just summing the actual function over either time direction is going to be interesting because, well, we've got two time variables. So if both marginals were going to be satisfied, it would have to add back to the original function in both directions. As it happens, adding it over t doesn't really do anything. It doesn't give you back much. Adding it over tau, on the other hand, does. So this is the inversion operation of the TT transform. And of course, in the discrete domain, it's exactly the same thing. I shouldn't say adding. I really should say integration. But I tend to think in the discrete domain whether I'm talking about the continuous or discrete domains. And of course, both of the these expressions require this condition to be fulfilled. The time integral of the window has to be equal to 1. Now, one interesting property of the time-time transform is that because of the fact that we now have different frequencies having their amplitude concentrated in different places on the time-time plane, it opens up the possibility of time-time filtering as sort of an alternative to time-frequency filtering. One simple way of doing time-frequency filtering with the S-transform is just to take the inversion algorithm and add a time-frequency filter to it, just a masking function, something between 0 and 1, and get back some filtered version of the Fourier spectrum from that, from which you can get back a filtered time series or filtered function in the continuous realm. Same sort of thing can be done in the time-time case. Just take the TT transform, multiply it by an appropriate time-time filter, and you'll get back some sort of windowed function or windowed time series. And with the high frequencies being more concentrated around t equals tau, in a way it'll sort of have multi-resolution properties. So this is an example of the type of filter that you might want to use if you wanted to get rid of the high frequencies at selected times. This has been set up so that it's going to block out the second half of that high frequency burst. Then we've got a progressive low-pass filter occurring throughout the rest of the function. And there's also going to be a range of the time index T where it's not active. Now, because of the fact that the inversion of the TT transform involves summing over this direction, you can see that any values of T for which there's no filtering happening are going to be completely unaffected by the filtering operation. The time series will not be affected by the filtering operation at all. So here's what you get from that. Right here you can see where I've used the masking function to block out part of the high frequency burst. That's the corresponding effect on the S transform. And this is really kind of here, incidentally, the one change in this overhead as compared with previous ones is that instead of repeating the time series, the original time series, what I've done is in the right-hand subplot in the middle, shown the overall effect of the filter. And these are the time-local time series after the filter's been applied. Right here, we can see what the disadvantage of the time-time filtering is, and that is that although it has pretty good time localization properties, it's very rough in the frequency direction. If we apply a mask to this area, well, we can see that we're going to block out the amplitude of the high frequency, but we're also going to hit some of the low frequency as well. So we get very precise resolution in time. This chunk of the time series is totally unaffected, but our frequency response isn't as good. The continuous domain is something that I spent quite a lot of time playing around with, which is why I called this overhead pulling teeth in the continuous domain. Some of the results, incidentally, that I've gotten here, that I'll show here, were done in collaboration with Dr. Wong and Dr. Zhu from York, and I'm indebted to them for helping me work this out. all of the examples that I've shown up till now in terms of results have been, of course, obtained in the discrete domain. But you can do this in the continuous domain as well. The only thing is that there are some snags that you have to get past. Instead of using the inverse discrete Fourier transform at each value of tau, instead what we want to do is take the continuous time, or continuous frequency, I suppose I should call it, inverse Fourier transform of the continuous version of the S transform. Well, one natural thing to want to try out when you're first doing this is, well, what's the analytic form for the TT transform of a monotonic complex sinusoid? If you can't figure this one out, you probably won't be able to figure out anything else. Well, it turns out that you can work out without too much trouble the analytic form for the S transform of a monotonic complex sinusoid with a frequency of k-naught. It turns out to be this. But you then will run into some difficulties with taking the inverse Fourier transform of this through the k variable because of the fact that when you go to large positive and negative values of k, this thing doesn't drop away to zero. It drops away to e to the minus 2 pi squared. So the S transform in this sense isn't really a particularly well-behaved function, but as it turns out, you can get past this roadblock. And after working your way through a lot of things that I'm not going to show in detail, just to avoid taking half an hour on that, you can get a couple of continuous time expressions for the TT transform. And what we have here is the TT transform of an arbitrary function f of t. Okay, this isn't just a complex sinusoid anymore. There are two expressions that are both pretty interesting in different ways. So I'll show the first one first. Well, this is the representation in terms of the Fourier transform. And the reason that this representation is kind of neat, I'll show over here. Just make myself some room here. Okay, that's the usual inverse continuous Fourier transform. So what we have here is just the function being represented as a superposition of complex sinusoids with their amplitudes and phases being given by these coefficients. When you look at the TT transform, what you have are exactly the same coefficients, and instead of the complex sinusoids, you have this. Well, what it turns out is that this is the TT transform of that, okay? So whereas here the function is being represented as a superposition of complex sinusoids with these coefficients, in equation 15, the function, or the TT transform of the function, is being represented as a superposition of the TT transforms of complex sinusoids with exactly the same coefficients. There's also this, I think of it as a razor function. It's a delta function that runs right across the tau equals t line. This is the thing that results from the fact that the S transform's absolute value doesn't drop away to zero at high positive and negative frequencies. You have to invoke this in order to make the problem tractable. So that's the first expression. The second one shows the TT transform. Well, everything that I've shown up to this point has shown the TT transform in terms of, as being rather, something that you can get from either the S transform or from the Fourier transform of the original function. But you can also get it as an integral transform with this representation. So here it is in terms of the original function. And the interesting thing here is that the kernel turns out to be, well, it turns out to contain a derivative of the Dawson integral, which is a function that pops up in physics in a lot of places. Now, this doesn't work as well as the other representation because it can't handle the t equals tau case. What happens there is that the argument of Dawson's integral just goes to root 2 pi, so the derivative drops to 0. This also goes to 0, so you get a 0 over 0. But it works every place else, and it's a nice expression. And just to show that the idea of, well, that time-time distributions have actually been around for a lot longer than this, here's the one that's associated with the Wigner-Ville distribution, which is just the instantaneous autocorrelation function. So I can write the Wigner distribution also using these arrows that I used previously. The instantaneous autocorrelation function, of course, is very different because it doesn't have that amplitude concentration towards tau equals t that the other two that we've looked at have. But it is, in a sense, a time-time distribution because it's a function of tau and t. So at this point, I'll move along to the two-dimensional case, which has its own challenges, but it's very interesting. There's a couple of different ways of defining the window of the two-dimensional S transform. One possibility is to use separate X and Y windows and just multiply them together so that you have two Gaussians in the different directions. The one that I prefer to use is one that has circular symmetry because it's more, I think, true to the basic idea that the window should taper at a rate that's proportional to the wavelength. So if you were to look at that window as being, the window incidentally is the term inside the curly braces, of course, if you were to look at it from above as a contour diagram, it would look like a bunch of concentric circles. And if you were to look at it in profile, it would look like a Gaussian. So this is where you get, this is where you get your two-dimensional TT transform from. And incidentally, I'm showing this in integral form, but I actually have only really done this in the discrete domain. The continuous domain form is something that still hasn't really been worked out in detail. The one-dimensional case, yes, but not the two-dimensional case. So going once again to the discrete case, of course, just so that I can get my results, here's a test image that's just four different monotonic sinusoids in 2D that all have different directions and different wavelengths. And this is its two-dimensional discrete Fourier transform. I put the zero frequency in the middle so that you can see the conjugate pairs. And in the next few overheads, what I'll show are the test image and the Fourier transform in the same positions, but I'll show the local spectra and the local image of the S and TT transforms in the bottom part. So what I've done here is selected a pixel that's in the middle of the top left quadrant and calculated its S transform just for that point. So this is the local spectrum of the S transform through that pixel. And you can see that, of course, well, we're selecting a point that's in the middle of this quadrant, so what it's mostly seeing here is just the peaks associated with that particular wave vector. This is what the TT transform looks like, and it's localizing it reasonably well around the window midpoint. Of course, the whole quadrant isn't much bigger than this, but you can see that the amplitude is dropping off towards the edges. And correspondingly, of course, because there's a little bit more localization in space, these peaks are spreading out a bit more in frequency, or wave vector, I suppose I should say. Now, here what I've done is selected a pixel that's in the lower right quadrant, which has a higher frequency. And when you calculate the local spectrum for that pixel, you get this. Here you're really more seeing the result of the multi-resolution nature of the S transform. Of course, since we're now looking at a higher frequency, the window is getting narrower in the time domain, so it's going to get wider in frequency, and we're going to get more smearing in the frequency domain or the wave vector domain. And this is the TT transform that we get from that. So it's not too much of a surprise to see most of the amplitude being localized in this way. It's exactly what we saw on the previous overhead. But now, I hope that you can see this. It's not particularly obvious, but there's a little bit of amplitude right about here, if you can see that. And what you're seeing here is just a little bit of this. The peaks and troughs correspond to the peaks and troughs right here in this region. And again, what we're seeing is the same sort of thing that we saw in the one-dimensional case. The TT image, if I can call it that, will see any particular wavelength out to maybe two or three wavelengths away from this central point. For this higher frequency, that corresponds to maybe this distance. But this frequency is lower. And because the lower frequency has a longer wavelength, it's visible further away from the middle. And you can see right here and here, those are the peaks associated with that. This is what happens if you select the pixel in the middle and take a local spectrum of that, which really shows how the frequency resolution gets worse at larger amplitude wave vectors. And again, you can see here the shorter wavelengths are being localized more strongly about the midpoint, whereas the longer wavelengths are allowed to spread out a little bit further, and they also have lower amplitudes. Well, having just shown the way that different frequencies are localized, again, I want to go back to the idea of looking at a monotonic sinusoid, which I already did for the 1D case. And once again, I'm going to look at a complex monotonic sinusoid so that I can look at its instantaneous frequency. So I've selected one just for simplicity, which has a value, I think, kx equals 12 I used, and ky equals 0. And then selecting the pixel in the middle around which to localize the function. These are the real and imaginary parts. And from those, you can get the phase and the amplitude overall. Now, let's compare the phase angle of the original function, or the original image, with the phase angle of the TT transform. And again, we can see that you've got this increase in instantaneous frequency, which of course is going to be the gradient of this thing, towards the window midpoint in the center of the image, and there's a lessening of the rate of phase change further away. And again, of course, the interesting thing here, another interesting thing here, is that there's a phase change along the vertical direction in addition to the horizontal direction, although of course the horizontal direction gets the lion's share. Just about the last thing that I wanted to show, going back to what's on the previous few slides, well, the closest thing to the instantaneous frequency that you can get in two dimensions, at least that I could think of, was the magnitude of the gradient of the phase. And so this is what you get for that TT transform image, where the yellows are higher values and the blues are lower values. Just for comparison, on this color scale, the instantaneous frequency of the original image would have been in the greens. So the yellows show that, once again, as in the 1D case, it's higher towards the middle and it's lower towards the outside. And this is the absolute value, which I'm taking from the real and imaginary parts that I showed a while ago. Now, this image is actually has the same scale on the horizontal and vertical axes. And once again, you can see that we have, well, something that I haven't completely figured out is that the TT transform's amplitude isn't completely symmetrical. We do see the same sort of effects that were in the one-dimensional case, but well, basically, if you look closer to the middle, closer into the red region here, you'll notice that the contours are stretched a little bit this way, whereas if you look further out towards the edges, they're stretched the other way. I'm sure that that's got some sort of intuitive interpretation. I mean, the reason I think that it happens mathematically is because of the asymmetry of the S-transform local spectrum. But But I like to be able to think of things in terms of physical analogies, and I haven't been able to come up yet with one that describes that. So, where next? Some things that I'd really like to do, for one thing, is finish working out the expression for two-dimensional images in the continuous domain. Another nice thing to have would be, other than just this being something interesting that is nice to show people, would be an application. And I think there might be one in earthquake seismology. And Jing Dedu, who used to be at York University and is now out in Calgary working with me, has suggested that it may have some applications to window design, that if you had some sort of idealized way that you would like your function to be localized around a certain midpoint, you might be able to figure out a way of designing an ideal window in terms of the way that it varies in frequency. Another thing that I've been playing around with a little bit is the idea of replacing the function with its TT transform in the definition of the Wigner-Ville distribution, which I think should have some interesting properties, but I've only played around with it a bit so far. The last couple of things are, is there a better way of coming up with a multi-resolution time-time distribution? I mean, the one that I've used is fairly simple, just the idea of taking the inverse Fourier transform of a local spectrum of the S transform. Perhaps that isn't the only way of doing it. I haven't been able to think of any others. Maybe they're out there. The other thing is, well, the big disadvantage of the TT transform is that you need to calculate the full S transform in order to get it. And of course, since for an n-length time series in the discrete case, that's going to give you an n-squared memory usage. Things get out of control pretty quickly, particularly when you're talking about images. So does something analogous to this exist for something more sparse, like a frame representation? That's also an unanswered question. So I guess I'll stop there, just give some acknowledgments to Dr. Wong and Dr. Zhu, again, for helping with the continuous domain and for inviting me to this. Ross, I have to thank because I was working for him during the time that I was working out some of this stuff. It's too bad that Lalu Mancina can't be here. He's traveling right now, but he's been very much involved in developing the S-transform. The Fields Institute for picking up the tab, and also, well, last but not least, to my coworkers at Calgary Scientific, who were generous enough to allow me to take a week off work to come here. That's all I have to say. Thanks.